Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Sluder v. Sluder.
May it please the court, Mr. Phil Fry will present argument to petitioner. Petitioner can reserve 6 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, permit me first to introduce to you Mr. Tom Alvis, who is representing the co-petitioner, the husband's father. The points on which he sought the granting of the writ were not specifically granted by the court. They were granted under the because convention, and Mr. Alvis wants the court to know that if there are any questions that the court feels need to be directed to him for the sake of the husband's father, he's ready to answer them. This is a tort claim expansion case. This was a divorce involving the transfer of funds by the husband to the husband's father. The jury verdict was rendered for constructive fraud upon that particular transaction. Judgment jointly and severally against the husband and against his father in the amount of approximately $13,000. There was a second verdict for exemplary damages, actually one against each, the husband and the father, $30,000 against the husband, $15,000 against the father. When the money judgments were added into the property division, along with the other property awarded to the wife, and when they were backed out of the property that was awarded to the husband, the net result of the property division was that the wife got 100% of the assets on hand and the husband got none. The prevailing rule in this type of case is that fraud and other economic wrongs are not independent causes of action in a divorce case. This is the rule of the Bells and the Moore and the Divine cases all cited in my brief. But the Third Court of Appeals below held that under this court's holdings in Bounds v. Caudle and Price and in Twyman, there is no impediment to an award of damages for an economic tort as part of a divorce. I respectfully suggest to the court that this begs the real question, and that the real question is whether the existing legal scheme for division of property incident to divorce adequately provides for economic wrongs.
What if all of the community estate is exhausted by the fraud? What's the spouse who's been defrauded, and what is their remedy?
Well, bear in mind that a divorce courts have traditionally had a money judgment power. The issue is not the granting of a money judgment. The issue here is granting it in the context of an independent tort. Now, what the courts have done is what the courts could do in the situation of your question. Let's assume a case where the community consisted of $100,000 and the court found that all of that had been wasted. Under the existing scheme of law, the court would have the power in the fair and just division of property to grant the wronged spouse a judgment for that $100,000 and in effect to deem that the wrongdoer spouse in effect had the benefit of that money wherever it is. So there is still a way to do it. The problem is that if you bring in the tort doctrine,
is that judgment enforceable against separate property, just as if it were any other judgment?
I think, and you pose a difficult question, I think the answer to that is perhaps not in the question, if you'll allow me to answer it in this way. The assumption is that the wrongdoing spouse had the benefit of that $100,000 of the wasted or concealed assets. That money may be in existence, it may not be in existence. If it is in existence, then there is the fund to pay the judgment. If it is not, then the answer has to be that it would lie against whatever assets that the judgment creditor could collect that may turn out to be such a property after the divorce.
And you said there's existing law that holds that a family court judge can enter a personal judgment that's enforceable against separate property.
Yes. Cases to that effect cited in the brief. Mr. Campbell will not disagree with that proposition of law. The court has always had that power for the sake of achieving what it believes to be an overall fair and just result in the division of the estate.
So what's the problem with the tort?
Punitive damages. Is that what it comes down to?
I'm sorry?
Punitive damages? Is that what
That's certainly the biggest problem. But before we get to punitive damages, there is also, I think... It is difficult for the trial courts to integrate a tort judgment into the overall property settlement. In the Twyman case, Justice Cornyn pointed out that the award, of course, in that case it was for a personal injury tort of emotional harm, that the award of personal injury tort damages does not relieve the court of the necessity of analyzing the overall division of property. And the gist of my argument to the court is that trial courts can handle divisions of property much better, much more accurately, much more justly if they use the traditional approach of unequal division of property to account for an economic wrong that may have occurred. There's no question, I mean, the law for decades has allowed trial courts to look at a fault generally, and specifically to look at the wasting of assets in making an unequal division.
Under my example, what's the legal basis for the money judgment? What do you call it?
Restoring the wasted property.
It's just awarding a money judgment flat out, then enforceable against separate property of the other side.
In the event, in fact, that the assets were just gone. Yes. However, you know, that problem exists whether we're talking about a judgment in tort or a judgment to equalize property division. If I may go a little bit further to try to respond to Justice Heck's question, this court fell into several errors with respect to the accounting in the case. One must look at the impact of these judgments on the overall property division. What the court got correct is the court did correctly treat the award of the almost $13,000 as a community asset. It was indeed, the suit was for the loss of community assets, and the court counted that in its balance sheet. On the other hand, the court completely ignored the liability side of the calculation and did not really weigh the impact of the $13,000 judgment and the $30,000 punitive damages on the husband's side. This is contrary to the established scheme, the Family Code Section 5.61D, which is now, if you'll forgive me, I'm the old dog with a new tricks problem in the new code, but I believe that's now 3.202, provides that all community property is subject to tortious liability. And even beyond that particular rule, basic accounting says that if you're going to take some money out of one account, if you're going to add money to one account, you're going to have to take it out of another account, your fundamental double entry rule. The judge ignored the impact of the judgments on the husband's side.
Well, in my example, was the judgment that the wife recovered the community property so that he would get half of the judgment against him?
No, because the award, in effect, takes care of that.
I thought your brief said that money judgments for property were community property as opposed to
yes.
Judgments for personal injury. Why would we
yes, but if the court The judgment is the means to the end. This was the point made in the Bells and the Moore cases. In the traditional scheme of dividing property, the fraud on the community doctrine is the means to raise the economic wrong and to get to the unequal division. The judgment then is the tool for transferring the money. The court in effect can do a couple of things. If there is still a lot of community-owned property on hand, the court can do what it did in Devine. No money judgment in Devine. The trial court simply pushed most of the assets over onto the wronged spouse's side, left a small portion on the wrongdoing spouses, observed that the wrongdoing spouse had the benefit of the several hundred thousand dollars. Or, in the alternative, the court, as it did in this case, could decide that the assets wouldn't equally, weren't readily divisible in a way to give the wife some compensation, if you will. And so, had the court done this one right, and so the court could have, in its analysis, have said, all right, we're going to put money judgment to equalize, to accomplish a fair and just result, leaving other assets on the other side, or leaving the wasted assets on the other side. But this is a familiar way of doing it. Trial judges in divorce cases, and I know Judge Spector heard divorce cases, are used to thinking about this. But when you throw the tort analysis in, I mean, what the trial court did here, and it really was the exemplary damages issue more than anything else, I think, that through this, the trial court may have considered that they were somehow different than the actual damages. But this case was all about economic loss. There was no pleading ever of any emotional harm in this case.
Excuse me for interrupting, but I'm not connected with where you're going. You talked about the double entry accounting here. Are you saying that the problem with the tort analysis is that it forgets that when the community property, including the money judgment, is pushed over to one spouse's side, it should be reflected as a negative on the other spouse's side, and the problem with the tort is you end up with a plus on one side without a corresponding negative on the other. Is that what you were going?
That was the trap that the trial judge in this case fell into, and that is the trap the traditional tort analysis.
And so what happens is that there is not in fact an equitable division of the marital estate because the spouse who is giving up portions of the community property is not being given credit for that tort damage.
Exactly that.
And so what resulted in 100% of the marital assets going to the wrong spouse would not have occurred if the $15,000 and the $30,000 figures had been considered a part of the marital estate to begin with. It would have shown that he was giving up $30,000 when it was transferred to her, but in this case it's not shown, and so a second $30,000 is shoved over there. I mean, is that where you're going with
this? I'm not suggesting a second $30,000 was shoved over there. I'm suggesting to you that the trial court may not even have been aware of the ultimate impact of the judgment. There are at least two indications in the record. The hearing on the judgment was some months after both of the parts of the bifurcated trial. And she made the statement, and it's the record citations, page 11 of my brief, quote, I'm doing our usual 60-40. If you look in the judgment, when the judgment deals with undivided property, any undivided property that may be out there, the judgment provides that would be divided 60-40. There's a strong indication she didn't even realize the impact, but the impact is clear. My brief contains an appendix which is fully supported by the findings of fact and by the judgment itself, which demonstrates, and I don't really think opposing counsel will challenge this, that this division was virtually 100 to zip. And ultimately, my argument to the court is that was an abuse of discretion, that there was not a fair and just division of the estate under these circumstances. But my suggestion for the jurisprudence is, that if you allow the tort doctrine, the tort judgments to be used, that you're going to have a lot of these cases crying to be reviewed here, because it's not the way the traditional legal scheme handles them.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you, Counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. John Campbell will present argument from respondents.
And I have with me today Mark Clements, who is an associate in a law firm who actually did most of the briefing on this and has also pretty much told me what to say today. The real crux of this case does have to do with whether or not Texas recognizes the right of a spouse to sue for actual fraud in a divorce context. Because it's from that, I think we have to agree with counsel that that generally speaking, and in fact I think the way the statute defined fraud and defined punitive damages and all, that constructive fraud will not support punitive damages.
Do you agree that if one spouse, in essence, steals from the community, that the trial court can restore that in the allocation of community property between the two spouses?
I think they can do that and more.
And render a judgment, as counsel indicated?
Yes, sir.
That would be enforceable against even the separate property?
Yes, sir. And I think for years and years and years, the courts have granted judgments, money judgments, not only to restore property, but also for oilty. In other words, where there's not enough property in the estate and where you have a business, for example, to even out, courts have been allowed, that was the Kidd case, where the court granted a money judgment to even out the division. But we concede that we need to go further than that. And so in this case, you need to consider that this case is different from Belts. It's different from all of the other cases that Belts cites, because what Belts says, and if it's correct, then we're out in the cold. Here's what Belts says, the way I read it, that in a divorce context, you cannot have an independent action for actual fraud. That just by its very nature, the relationship in a divorce is constructive fraud in dissipation of assets.
Why do you need it if the trial judge can do the same thing by dividing the community and rendering a judgment?
You need it for a couple of reasons. One, punitive damages, and the reason you need it for that is this court in Young said that you cannot use a division of property to punish. And when someone does something wrong in the divorce context, then the only way they can be punished, and we all know that punitive damage is a very salutary concept because it is how the courts control the actions of parties in divorce cases. And that's extremely important in this case because in this case, the petitioner and his father conspired in the process of planning this divorce to move property from the community over to the father. And that's exactly what they did. When the husband was retiring, he turned his incentive money, which was about $30,000, over to his father. His father put it in his account, the father's account. And from there, they used up this $30,000 so that when the court came to divide up the property, $30,000 was gone. In addition to that, the husband sold to his father, and all of this in contemplation of the divorce. We're not talking about something during the marriage like we had in the Zeke where the philandering husband there was out dissipating assets, running around with women and all of that. We recognize that is a constructive fraud situation. But in this case, in the context of getting a divorce, planning and knowing we're going to be going to court to get a divorce, we're going to do this to manipulate. And not only manipulate the wife, but also to manipulate the court, because that money was removed, and it was gone when came time to have the divorce proceeding. And in the process, and this is, I think, an important point, In the process, the wife spent about $25,000 in getting ready for the lawsuit, and someone might say, well, why in the world would you do that? Well, I think one of the basic principles in family law and in any other case is that everybody be honest. They be honest in their depositions. They be honest in dealing with the other side. They be honest in the court. And this case is replete with dishonesty. For example, in depositions, we all sit around tables with lawyers and with parties. And the parties in this case, the Sluder family, all swore under oath, we owed, or Richard, the husband, owes the father money because of money that the father loaned to him over the years. And they had these little notes, and they had little strips of paper, and this, that, and the other, and they said, we execute each time we loaned Richard money, we made him sign an oath, each time, each time. And then, when we got to trial, the court had ordered them to turn those so-called notes over to us. So we had them examined, and we had a forensic expert who testified those notes could not have been executed back when they said they were. They had to have been executed later, and so it turned out that at trial they came in with an estate tax planner who said, oh yes, later on we advised them. We knew that they were keeping some kind of record in a notebook of these notes and all, but we advised them to reduce them to writing. And so they fabricated all of these notes, and we proved that with the forensic examiner. So what we have here is a case of intentional, outright fraud against not only the wife, but against the court.
But you're saying the court can't take that into account in allocating the community?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not saying they can't take it into account. That's where, and I believe in the opinion in Twine, I think it was this court that was concerned about double recovery. And that is a problem. But the question is, can a trial court separate that out? And if they can't, then an appellate court can deal with it. Yes, they can take it into account, but they should not take it into account and at the same time grant a tort recovery.
But could the trial court say, I think you lied to me the whole case, and therefore I'm going to give the other side 10% more of the community?
Well, Your Honor, I think that...
just in so many words.
Yes, sir. I think that might fly in the face of Young, because Young says we should not punish a person for wrongdoing. And that's why I think we need the punitive damages.
Was Young a no-fault divorce?
Your Honor, I'm going to think about that for just a moment. No, Young was not a no-fault divorce. As I recall it, there's adultery. There was cruelty, and that's what the court said. That, in fact, I think the other side was arguing that fault should not have been considered at all. And in that case, the appellate court made the point of the fact that the jury had actually found adultery and cruelty in addition to other factors, and that justified the award in that case, the disproportionate division of the property. But at the same time, frankly, I'm not real sure.
And this court said you couldn't do that?
This court said, no, as a matter of fact, in the Young case, there was a disproportionate division. But in the same language, they said you cannot use those actions to punish.
Didn't they also say that it's a factor to consider in the division of the property?
That you could consider
fault.
Yes, sir. They did say that.
But you can't apparently just do it only for that fact.
Correct. There had to be.
Campbell, why wouldn't it be an appropriate line to draw where the injury against the spouse is a separate injury and allow a tort claim for the separate injury to the spouse as opposed to allowing an economic injury to the community be the basis for some sort of independent tort action? In other words, unless the wrong spouse has a claim for an action that would be a separate injury, either a personal injury or injury to the separate property of the spouse, why wouldn't it be a better rule to say all injuries that are claimed to the community by one spouse or the other simply be resolved by a redistribution of the community assets on a trial of the case and just not get involved in the tort aspects of the injury.
Well, I think that that limits the trial court and the remedies that they can impose.
The only remedy they'd be limited to would just simply be punitive damages.
Well, it would be punitive, and also, Your Honor, I think it might be conspiracy. I'm not real sure about that. They have not raised that point in their appeals, but I think that on the issue of conspiracy, in other words, in this case, the jury found that Hudson, the father, and the husband had conspired. And so the question is whether or not if you have only a constructive fraud, will it also support the conspiracy? And so, and we think here that there's certainly no reason why the wife cannot recover against the father for his wrongdoing in participating in the fraud.
Well, I guess I wasn't talking about constructive fraud. I understand that's how they talk about fraud in the community is constructive, but anything that would happen between the spouses,
yes, sir,
on a claim for damage to community asset would not have any impact on a claim against a third party, someone who's a stranger to the marriage. If there was a fraud on the community, the wrong spouse has just as much right to sue the wrongdoer as the wrongful spouse.
I see what you're saying, Your Honor, but I think the problem with that is, and in our case, we tried to distinguish that. We try to distinguish Karen's part of the community as opposed to the community as a whole. And you see, the way this all came about, and I think where the courts got confused, when Caudill was heard, that was the first time that you could, theoretically, have one spouse suing the other for intentional torts. And everybody concedes, I think, that actual fraud is an intentional tort. Well, that was in 1977. In 1972, in the Givens case, the court there had held that in an insurance case, and it was actually a probate case, but the court had defined there that the spouse who had been murdered or killed or whatever by the husband, that the spouse had to have had a cause of action against the husband, the deceased spouse had to have, for the survivors to sue the husband. And it was in that case where this doctrine of constructive fraud got started, and the Vels case, we think, fell into the idea that every divorce case is constructive fraud because you have the fiduciary duty. In spite of the fact that the Parker case, out of Fort Worth, said that you don't have a fiduciary relationship after you start a divorce, where everybody's represented by attorneys, there's no longer a fiduciary duty involved. And so you have those confusing elements. But again, I'm not sure that I'm hitting on the point here, but what I'm trying to say is that a wrong by one spouse against another spouse in a marriage may deal only with that injured spouse's community property because that may be all she has. But it's still an actual fraud, as it was in this case, and it still should support punitive damages, and it still should support a conspiracy.
There's an argument that these kinds of actions cause additional strife in the divorce situation context.
Well, Your Honor, I think that was
too expensive a price to pay.
I just think that was taken care of when this court did away with the interspousal immunity. To me, that was saying, look, times have changed, and that's what the Franco case said. Times have changed. Women now are not one and the same person as the man, the wife, the husband, and we've progressed beyond that, and it is archaic for us to think that these wrongs that occur in marriage should somewhere or another be treated differently than they would be if it was outside the marriage. Why should they be? Why should a wrong, an actual fraud, malicious, mischief, any kind of damage just to destroy. You could have a case where a husband just goes out and destroys. Or I remember one old case where the husband flushed money down the toilet. And those kinds of things. Why can't we sue for those kinds of injuries just like you can against third parties? That's what Bells would say, is that case, none of those cases, can you sue the spouse because there's this fiduciary relationship, and that sort of insulates or isolates.
Are we going to see a fraud and punitive damage claim in most divorces if we direct no cause of action?
I don't really think so. I think that what will continue to happen, because you don't have this kind of blatant...
Well, what about when a couple knows they're on the rocks and one couple cleans out the bank account and goes and hires a lawyer? Isn't that a fraud on the community? It was intentional. Wouldn't that fit within your definition of what happened?
Well, I don't really think so, Your Honor, because in the first place, even when you go to court and get a restraining order and restrain people from doing anything, use the property, one of the exceptions is clean it out for attorney's fees. Now, the attorneys may have had something to do with getting that kind of a law passed, but that is one thing, I know I'm focusing on your exact question, but I do think, again, the issue here is how much discretion do we leave with the courts? With the trial court.
But if you allege fraud and you say, here are my facts, don't you get a jury trial on fraud and punitive damage?
And you still got to prove it.
You got to prove it.
You still got to prove it.
That one spouse cleaned out the bank account and went and rented an apartment and hired a lawyer. This was pre-filing. And then filed the lawsuit.
Well, I'm not going to say that that couldn't happen. I can only say to you that in my experience in the law practice, it hasn't happened. You know, the same kind of scare thought came up when we opened the doors in Bounds v. Caudill, and that has not created or generated any unusual increase in trials. And so I do think there's always going to be that issue, and certainly it ought to be available. If one spouse, why shouldn't he? Why should the wife not have a remedy if the husband goes and draws out $25,000 out of the bank account, and now she doesn't even have the money to...
But I thought you said the trial court could take care of that in the division of the property
in several ways.
But what I'm talking about is fraud and a punitive damages issue on top of that.
But here, bear in mind that to prove actual fraud, you've got to prove dishonesty. What's dishonest about a husband going to his bank account and taking money out? You've got to prove deception. In other words, we're not just talking about...
Well, let's say it's a joint account and he needs her signature. He says, honey, I'm going to go buy you a new car. Will you sign this so I can take the money out? She says, all right. Instead of doing that, he cleans out the bank account.
That may very well be...
Moves out and hires a lawyer.
And why shouldn't it be? If somebody lies. In the law, people should be made to be honest. That's why we have punitive damages. People should not be allowed to tell the wife. In fact, that's what happened in the Vickery case that you folks will probably be hearing. The husband told the wife a lot of things like that, and she believed them. Why shouldn't she? And if she's injured, why shouldn't she have a right to sue him for whatever, if he in fact has damaged her? But you've still got, if you believe in our system, and I believe in our jury system, I believe in our court system, that if that's wrong enough for a jury to find that it was dishonest, it was deceptive, then I think she ought to be entitled to
it. Do you agree, Mr. Fisher, that under existing law, the trial court can enter a money judgment that's enforceable against the other spouse against their separate property?
Yes.
And just straight up a division of the community?
Well, I'm not sure I understood your question.
Under what circumstances can a trial court say, I don't think there's enough community property, therefore I'm awarding one spouse a money judgment that's enforceable against the other separate property?
Well, no, I do not believe that you can do that. The court can, as I said earlier, in other words, what these courts have said with regard to giving money judgments is either it's got to be to bring back property that's been removed wrongfully or to even out the division of the property. So there's got to be something referable. In other words, there's got to be property there referable. No, I do not believe a court can go after the separate property of either spouse. Except they certainly you could enforce a judgment if in fact this court allows an independent tort, then yes, I believe that damage award could be used to levy. Unfortunately, in this case, and it's one of our findings of fact, the husband is judgment proof. He has no assets except his $54,000 retirement that he got out of this
but
case.
But that doesn't depend on a judgment for the independent tort. There could be a money judgment on the property division where there's a dollar judgment against the gentleman in this case, and if she goes out and executes on that, she may be executing on some separate property. It's just that the divorce court has no authority to transfer title.
That's correct. I agree with that.
If Belts is the law, are there jury issues in trying to determine the proper allocation of the community?
Your Honor, I think there would be advisory questions. I do not believe there would be any.
You wouldn't have to submit them to a jury?
Well, you could submit them as an advisory, for an advisory.
But on a fraud claim, you'd be entitled to a jury.
And on actual fraud?
Yes.
Yes, sir. That would be our position. And we think that that is the correct position. And I thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Commissioner.
May it please the court. Young definitely does say that the court may consider fault. The opinion below explicitly says the court may consider the wasting of community assets in an unequal division. There's no question about that law. Secondly, please be clear that this case is a constructive fraud case. Take time to go back and read the charge to the jury, the issues that were submitted, the definition of fraud. That's given in the first issue is that fraud arises when a party transfers community property or expends community funds for the primary purpose of depriving the other spouse, blah, blah. It is not a classic fraud case wherein a party makes a statement or fails to make a statement and the other party relies on that to their detriment. But I'll go one beyond that. I will suggest to you that the distinction between the constructive fraud and the actual fraud is not really what's vital here. And it's important, just in looking at Vickery, as I know, you're going to have to look at Vickery in this case, whether or not you get it for review. The big difference in Vickery, and this goes to your question, Your Honor, as to where do you draw the line? You draw the line where you've already drawn it, and that is on the one side, personal injuries. Injuries to the body, injuries to reputation, those injuries and harms that have always been defined as personal. And then on the other side, economic torts. That's where it makes sense to draw the line. In Vickery, the wife there pleaded and recovered a verdict for emotional harm. And on top of that, recovered a verdict for exemplary damages. That's what really separates out Vickery from the case at bar. But to come back to the distinction I'm urging, this distinction lines up with all of our prior law. In the first place, it fits the statute. The family code, the old section 5.01, forgive me for not knowing the new section, says that all property possessed during marriage is community property other than that which is separate property. And then you look at the separate property statute, and it does create the special category of recovery for personal injuries. Personal injuries. This goes back to Graham versus Franco. And forgive me for fumbling here. There is a quote in Graham v. versus Franco where, remember, Graham versus Franco was wrestling with whether or not to bring recovery for personal injuries into the category of separate property. Up to that time, it was considered that it was a shows in action, a cause of action, it was property, it could be sold. And Graham decided that no, the better rule of the personal injury damages a separate property. But in Graham, quoting from the railway case versus Freeman, the court stated, mere personal torts die with the party and are not assignable. Such are actions of slander, libel, assault and battery, false imprisonment, criminal conversation, seduction, etc. On the other hand, when the injury affects the estate rather than the person, when the action is brought for damages to the estate and not for the injury to the person, personal feelings or character, the right of action could be bought or sold. Now clearly the court at the time of Graham v. Franco had in mind retaining this distinction between the economic harm, on the other hand, and the personal injury harm to the other side.
I agree with you and send this case back for whatever reason.
It has to be remanded. I suggested that perhaps there could be a rendition, but I have to back away from that. The court is entitled to consider the overall division of property in light of all these factors.
And the court can enter the same judgment that
I don't believe it could. I mean, I do not. Well, My proposition to this court that a 100% to 0% is an abuse of discretion in this case, and virtually in any case, I don't think the facts support that. And again, I will suggest to you that I'm not sure this trial judge intended to effect a 100% to 0%, and judging from her comment on the record and judging from another provision of the judgment. Forgive me.
Like, if the trial judge were to do that, the standard of review would be abuse of discretion.
Yes, and that's one. I mean, this to keep the traditional scheme, frankly, makes review easier and more appropriate. It's easier to look at the totality of the case rather than the kind of review you have in a tort scheme where you're on the softer legal sands of remittiture. And the flood of cases, I mean, I don't know whether it's going to be a flood of cases, but if you allow the economic tort to come in, it's going to be more attractive for the trial lawyers to associate in these cases and to go for the big exemplary damage reward, which may bear no relationship whatsoever to the overall size of the community estate. Because once you've recognized this economic tort, you've let that one loose.
Is it your position that the judgment against the husband's father in this case would be community or separate property? You said in your brief
it's community
property.
It's community.
So the court should divide it each abuse of discretion on remand.
There's no question. I mean, all of these damages were for replacement of the lost money, and the exemplaries as well have to be viewed as community, not only under the statutory scheme, Graham versus Franco, Arnold versus Leonard, but also you have the Rosenbaum opinion, commission appeals, Judge Hickman opinion adopted by this court, which looked at this question of the relationship of the exemplary damages to the actual damages and held that they take their character from the actual damages. All of these damages were for the economic loss. That's the appropriate way to do it.
Is it your premise that because there's a difference between personal injury damages and economic damages, therefore actual fraud should not be an independent tort in this situation?
I would maintain that. I think that's a sensible place. It's a logical place to draw the line.
You're not saying that you're not entitled to get exemplary damages in an economic loss situation, though.
I am saying that in a divorce case, that is not the existing legal scheme, and that there is no reason for this court to depart from that legal scheme. That the existing legal scheme can take that into consideration in the overall division, and in effect, recognize it in some way.
But you do agree that Twyman says that we do recognize tort litigation by one spouse against another.
No question, Your Honor.
But then why
Twyman,
should we just
Twyman
have...
was a personal injury. Twyman
if you do
was
that,
an intentional infliction of emotional harm.
If you do that, why should we have a special rule based on the nature of the damages?
Forgive me, it seems like that takes me back through my entire argument.
Well, no, just... it's because the damages are different in your view, so you shouldn't allow the tort. Is that correct?
Well, I think they're different. I think in the end, perhaps these reasons go as much towards sound judicial administration as anything else. We have a system that works. We have a system that allows the court to take this kind of conduct into consideration. We have a system that allows the court, in effect, to compensate for it. And we have a system which, on review, allows the appellate court to take a comprehensive view of the overall property division and make a decision on whether or not, as the statute requires, it was fair and just.
Our job is to kind of play hypothetical, but let's assume there's a small law partnership. Two of the members are a husband and a wife, and the wife affirmatively defrauds her other partners. We've got actionable fraud, and the individual partners sue the wife, and in the meantime, the husband also sues the wife for divorce. Or under your rationale, that other partners would have a cause of action against the husband for fraud, but not the wife. Is that correct?
The husband wouldn't have a cause of action against the wife for fraud.
Where you've got business relationships and others involved, and do we just say, well, because you're a husband and a wife, there's no fraud here?
the remedy would fit very neatly within the existing scheme. I mean, suppose that the other partner's suit resulted in a judgment which depleted the community estate. Clearly, that's economic loss. Clearly, that would be a factor to be considered.
They get punitive damages. Does that husband, who was a partner, does he foreclose from getting punitive damages from his spouse?
That's the way I would write the law, and I would leave the court to its unequal division power and its money judgment power to arrive at a fair and just division, to take that into consideration and to compensate for it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the arguments for today. The marshal will now please adjourn the court.
All rise.